What I want to talk about is said in the title is method for realizing algebraic attacks against block ciphers, which is probably not that well known as some of the other methods. So I'll spend quite some time in the talk just kind of repeating the main features, characteristics of this attack, and then discuss to what extent this attack could be attractive if we consider not only software implementations, but possibly doing it in hardware. But I don't intend to go into any hardware details here, but I would like to give an idea kind of how a control flow will roughly look like. Okay, I guess we have here some funny freeze property, which I'll leave for the moment. So the essential idea of algebraic attack, which I guess most of you have seen at some point, is you start with symmetric primitive and you try in one or the other way to set up a system of nonlinear equations, polynomial ones, and then you hope to solve this using some machinery for polynomial equations. And main controversy is basically about AES, where the system seems to have nice structure, but not so obvious how to exploit it. And the essential problem with this approach is kind of, for ciphers of interest, you don't know how to solve the system of equations. And the most popular tools I'm aware of is some form of Gribner basis techniques, if you want to list XL separately, list it separately. Orban tries to use such solvers, which was around the key lock, kind of the method of choice, and I seem to have worked well. The main issue here is that there is nothing specific about schemes coming from block ciphers, for instance. Gribner basis is just kind of the general hammer, if you want. Yeah, you have a system of polynomial equations, lexicographic Gribner basis, let's hope it works in one or the other tricky way. And the method I want to talk about here is this multiple right-hand sides method. I'm not sure when exactly it was invented, so the journal article is rather late. That's in the Science Codes and Crypto. It's from 2008, but it was at least available in 2007. I'm not sure when kind of the first versions were floating around. And the nice thing about, or the interesting feature of this method is that it seems very well tailored for schemes, for polynomial system of equations, or systems of equations as they come up when you look at particular block ciphers. There is a way to say, okay, I can use it in principle to attack other systems of polynomial equations and rewrite it this way, but that's not quite the point. The idea is that in some scenarios this seems a natural thing to do, to use this formulation. And roughly, what is it about? So what we have is we start with a matrix. All is over GF2, or the whole thing I discussed in the talk is all over GF2, so my fields are rather simple. And I have a bunch of column vectors. What you should think of is that you have here many B's, which are not very high. Yeah, you can have here really thousands of B's. And the A itself is nothing that dramatic. So you can think of K being comparatively small. So these things are wide, but not high. So that's kind of what you should think about. And a system of such a multiple right-hand side equation is a vector x, which solves one of the linear equations which you've written down here. Yeah, if ax equals b5, we're good, then x is a solution. And if ax equals b7, it's also a solution. There just has to be at least one bread fit. So the common terminology, whether it's good or not, is kind of to refer to these guys as symbols, because it's just shorter. And notation is kind of these brackets just to make it's not really a matrix which is written there. It's just a collection of columns. And when we look at ciphers, what you obtain is not one such equation, but you obtain a couple of symbols, and we look for an X which satisfies all of them simultaneously. In other words, in each symbol we find a column so that it works. That's in a system of symbols. And to give, I would just want to give a rough idea how to come up with these MRHS equations when you start with a cipher. And it would be a lie to say this always works fantastically. For some ciphers, it works very natural. In particular, this Feistel structure is kind of very nice, and it works well. Also for AES, you end up kind of with a reasonable size system, a few hundred symbols. It's not that bad. we played recently with another cipher, and at some point said it's just the wrong tool. So, but there are several ciphers of interest where it works nicely. So what is the rough idea? Essentially, the first thing you have to do is to introduce a bunch of variables, and the ARP is kind of what is the best way to do it. You will introduce, of course, variables for each key bit. Kind of the aim is at the end that we have a system of equations which we can solve for the variables expressing the key. And we assume we are given a plain text ciphertext pair, and one will introduce variables which represent intermediate values in the algorithm. And the idea is to choose the variables in such a way that all the intermediate states, all the nonlinear values, can essentially be expressed in linear expressions in the variables we introduce. I explained it here with DES. So what would be a canonical choice? We have 56 variables for the key bits, the parities you forget. Then one what would typically do is introduce variables for the output of the nonlinear function f here, of the round function. And with these variables, you kind of hide that you have no idea for the moment what's going on in F, which contains the nonlinear part of the F boxes. Once you have these variables and introduce new variables for each round for the nonlinear part, you can express the input and the output of each F box, of the complete nonlinear part, as a linear combination of the variables you have and of some known constants, namely the plain text and the ciphertext. Yeah, you kind of know what's coming in here. For this, you have variables. This allows you to express the output here and the input here as a linear combination of the variables and the plain text ciphertext bits. Kind of it's a bit of fumble if actually doing it, but you can express it. And so far, it's moderately helpful because we completely ignore what's actually going on in here. And now that's exactly where the symbols come in. The idea is not kind of neat. So suppose we have an expression for the input of our S box as some matrix times our variables plus some linear combination of the plain text ciphertext stuff. And we have the same story for the output of the S box. So we have a linear combination of the variables and a linear combination of these known constants. Then we know that not arbitrary value combinations are possible for this input-output, but they have to match what is going on here in the cipher. So what one forms essentially a vector which is kind of input to the S-box, output to the S-box, and this vector has only certain values, namely input to the S-box, output to the S-box. The S-box itself is small, yeah? Say it's a 6 to 4 S-box. So you iterate over all inputs here for each vector, the corresponding output. And you know kind of if you have the correct assignment for the encryption which was actually going on for this plain text ciphertext production, there is a consistent solution for your variables which matches all these equations. The only problem we have, we don't know, well, which of these S-box values was actually occurring. That's what, where the symbol comes in. You iterate over all possibilities. So what you obtain for AES, AES looks slightly different. For DES, you obtain symbols for each S-box. You introduce such a symbol where you have 6 plus 4 rows, an S-box, 6 to 4. And you have as many right-hand sides, well, you iterate over all possible input values to the S-box there. And you say kind of, well, one of them it has to be. So this gives you one of these symbols. And you have then a bunch of them because you have a bunch of S-boxes in the algorithm. So in each round you have 8 of them. And so in this case here, I mean, that's a very neat explanation in a master thesis of Conan. But it's not very difficult, but it's kind of neat. This is the number of variables which you have, which is kind of moderate, and you have the number of symbols here. So the main point here is it's not outrageously large. Yeah. So writing down the system is kind of okay. And the feature is now that for a couple of ciphers, you can set up these systems. the question is now, yeah, fine, so how do I solve it? And that's where the method of Friedemann and Samaev comes in. Essentially, they propose the technique which has two main building blocks, which I'll discuss. One of them is known as the greeing of symbols, and one of them is known as gluing of symbols. Essentially, what is going on, you'll see, it's linear algebra that's going on here. And for actually doing it, there are lots of problems of the type, I would probably solve this with sorting and searching. So the idea is, when you look at this algorithm, all the working horses seem very well suited for actually doing it fast in hardware. What is the main problem of the algorithm? It's about as well understood as Scribner basis. We have no reasonable way to predict the running times. Yeah. So it's kind of unfair to criticize it too much because predicting running times of algebraic texts in general not that easy. And it's no way better here. So that's, in particular, whatever I discuss later in hardware, I will not make any claims about the feasibility of an attack because I know quite well what the device does, but I have not really a good understanding how MRHS behaves in the long term. You can do small experiments, but lacking the exact behavior of the analysis of the algorithm, I can only make kind of relative statements. That's the best we can do. Kind of sad, but that's how it is. So what are the main components which are happening in the algorithm? Actually, most of the time will be spent in agreeing symbols. So how does this look like? We have here a symbol, which is here kind of a matrix. I think here I've heard compact matrix, a few hundred times a few hundred, but nothing tremendous. And you have here a right-hand side, which is this collection of columns. I can give any of them. And the statement is that the symbols agree in the sense, well, it informally it means imposing both conditions makes any sense. As our system describes one complete encryption, so there should be kind of a consistent solution. And what agreeing does, it tries to kick out inconsistent right-hand sides. So the idea is when you take your matrix AI here, and you look at AX equals B and AIX equals B prime. So what you impose is that for each B which you grab from your symbol here, you find the B prime in the other symbols, but that the thing still has a solution. Yeah. If I have here a B which has no consistent partner on B prime, in other words, if I go the whole symbol here, this B nowhere makes any sense, I just can kick out this B. It's just inconsistent. And we do it the other way around, of course. So if there is a B prime somewhere in this list of columns, which has no partner over here, which makes the system consistent, we can kick it out. Okay, so the idea of disagreeing is to reduce the lists here. If you look at this operation, this already sounds a lot like find an element in there, perhaps sorting and then searching. It goes a lot in this direction. Okay. Radom and Samaev give a couple of approaches how to exactly do the agreeing. We'll do here in a way the simples, but it seemed kind of very nice to be to implement on hardware. One thing which is important to notice, if you started agreeing symbols, and say at some point you have two symbols which agree, and then you go on with one of these symbols and agree with another one, say, whoops, they don't agree, I have to kick out, or I can kick out some columns. This, of course, can have an impact on what you've done before, because suddenly maybe you've kicked out that partner which you needed exactly there. So it's kind of good news or bad news, so you have to kind of go back and say, well, let's re-agree because now maybe I can delete more columns. And so there can actually a whole chain reaction can occur. In a way, you hope that this happens because then your symbols become smaller. Okay, so simple method for agreeing. Now one could think, and there's still lots of work to be done, is there a clever way to agree five symbols simultaneously in some clever way? Not many results are available there. So what I will speak to here is this version here, which is known as a green one algorithm in their paper. Take a system, grab two symbols. If they disagree, make them so that they agree. And keep on going until there's nothing left which disagrees, and then we have to see on. How is the agreeing actually done? And that's a fair question. So what I describe here is, I won't give any proof here, but it's not too counterintuitive that it works. The method essentially, as Artemis might describe it, so you take your two symbols, you glue them, you juxtapose them vertically, and then you bring them in an upper triangular form. That's exactly what this transformation matrix does. T is nothing magic, T is just the size of this matrix, the name. So that at the bottom, in the bottom rows, you have a bunch of zeros, and up here you have this triangular form, all nice. And statement is, if you just have a full triangular form, no zeros at bottom, you're done, the symbols agree, nothing to be done. If you have really some zeros left down there, and you look at the product of this transformation matrix, which you get kind of from the echelon elimination, on these two matrices, you should obtain consistent results down there where you have a zero here. If this is the case, they're consistent, they agree. If this is not the case, you kick out those columns where you have no matching partner. Kind of, if you have here somewhere an entry in one of the products, but you have no partner over there, you can kick out a corresponding column. And you do this with both sides. So it kind of always has to be done for both partners. But essentially what has to be done here, if you look at it, essentially you need a neat linear algebra for getting this matrix U. And you need a reasonably fast way to see whether your partners are there on the other side. And if no, to kick them out. That's essentially all you need. It's again kind of sorting search linear algebra. That's the rest kind of details. What can well happen is you spend the day agreeing, and then there is nothing left to agree, and you're kind of stuck, and you just don't know the solution yet, but there's everything agrees. Then the second operation, but which in terms of running time is the way less critical, is known as gluing. So what gluing does, gluing reduces the number of symbols. So suppose we take two symbols which agree, say this guy, so everybody has a partner, and what one looks at is the matrix we just looked at, and we form a new matrix. The important role of this matrix, it replaces the old two symbols, kind of it summarizes the condition into one symbol, which in size-wise here is no problem. So the matrix which we create here is just take the old matrix and a part of it. Yeah, you kind of kick out what is not needed down there. So in terms of height, nothing is happening. It can get smaller, but nothing grows. The bad thing happens here on the multiple right-hand sides. What we have to do here, we have to combine right-hand sides from the two matrices. And essentially what happens, you have to look at your the same matrices as before, and you have to kind of look what value is here and there. And whenever a value is here and there, you have to form a column here. And in the worst case, say everything is identical, you can get drastic blow-ups here in the number of columns. So that's kind of the trouble. There must be a real problem with the algorithm. And it's actually here. So gluing two symbols, well, you have four symbols afterwards, but you have way wider right-hand sides. And it can, if you do it, the problem you can run into, you just can't afford to glue, yeah? So say you have here 2 to 20 right-hand sides, there are 2 to 20 right-hand sides, you say, well, maybe I just can't afford it, yeah? In my memory, to have 2 to the 30 or 40, the worst case, right-hand sides. So question, what do you do then? And the typical technique there is that, well, time to guess a variable. And then what you do, you guess one of the variables, you create a symbol which just says this variable is 1, or this variable is 0. And what you hope when you now do agreeing again, that you run into a situation where you encounter a symbol, well, either it goes on and you find a solution, or you quickly encounter a symbol where all right-hand sides get deleted. In other words, the system is completely inconsistent. Once you know that you have a symbol where all right-hand sides got deleted, you know your guess was wrong. Then you kind of roll back and make a different guess. Your hope is that this occurs quickly. If this occurs late in the tree, well, then you're kind of screwed. If it occurs quickly, you're lucky. The nice thing about it, in terms of memory behavior, this doesn't look too bad. You kind of know when you start guessing. You put your threshold, you say, well, more than a million right-hand sides I can't tolerate because my machine is out of memory. And then you go into time, yeah. And the issue what you have, of course, when you say you make a guess, you actually have to save some real estate. The state meaning will store the symbols which you currently have before the guess. And if okay, you have, in case you have to roll back, you'd like to have the place where you want to roll back to. Okay, but these are essentially the two main operations which occur. Now the idea was, does this thing fit into hardware? And we believe actually yes. So essentially we need two things. If you look at the sorting search engine in algebra, and the question is, what shall we work with? So the design choices we made was kind of a key, let's say a million right-hand sides that ended up having kind of reasonable amounts of memory, and it's about much more you don't really want to handle in software also. So that seemed kind of a reasonable trade-off. And the idea was the system should be able at least to host the systems which you need for a cipher of interest. And I kind of give an idea for an AES, you have less than 400 symbols lying around. For those of you who know Preston, that's kind of a more recent cipher, kind of for specialized environments. You have a bit more symbols. But the idea one that you should have in mind, the number of symbols is a few hundred. That's kind of what's going on. And that's a kind of more technical, when you estimate chip size at the end, we decided to use 45 nanometers, but that's more kind of for the hardware estimates. Okay, I said I don't want to go into much detail what exactly the, how the individual components look like, and I hope that the e-print will be out later this week, detailing that. Here's just kind of the rough workflow. The main part which we have is we have a bunch of main processing units, we call them. They're completely identical, and we just have a grid of them, so kind of MPU, 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 MPU. And kind of if you want to have the full machine, you would take something like 32 times 32. One could consider smaller ones, but it seemed kind of reasonable. And they are just connected as a grid, nothing fancy, you know, rubber rounds, nothing. Then we have somewhere in the north corner somewhere, we have kind of a central little control unit, which knows who does what and tells with some control wires who does what. And there's nothing too fancy going on. If you worry about kind of they are too far away, there are a bunch of intermediate stations which just help propagating signals. That's not too critical. This part is not too bad, I think. The main issue is kind of what are the MPUs doing and how does it work? So the idea is to parallelize this whole algorithm is that at the beginning you take your initial load of symbols and you just distribute them about evenly on your around the MPUs. Kind of two for you, two for you, two for you, two for you. And assume there are power, you have a power of two number of symbols. If you haven't, assume there's an empty symbol. That's okay. And what you will need, you'll see in later why, kind of you will have some snakes moving. We just need some Hamiltonian cycle kind of along the grid. Doesn't have to be anything fancy. The idea is just you have to go through each MPU once. In other words, you need all symbols and go back where you started. And we later exploit some parallelization and kind of do the same thing for half grids. But it really, there's nothing fancy about it. Just kind of move around it and that's nothing in terms of graph theory. The thing we have in mind at the beginning has something like two symbols per MPU and we're good. What we do, we label the symbols and so we take all MPUs and in each, say each one we have exactly two symbols. So we have symbols number one, symbols number two, symbols number... That's it. Actually, you can go up to four. More I really don't want to do. And the collection of all symbols with the same number, that's what we call a snake. And you'll see in a moment why. Because they kind of move together. And at one point in time, you'll see always only one of these snakes, one of these collection of symbols is really moving. This collection we call kind of the motile snake, and I hope it makes sense in a moment. So roughly, without any details, what is the device doing? Once you reach the stage where we have just one symbol left, well, the algorithm is done. And okay, you have one symbol, no. Hopefully there was only one consistent state of the encryption algorithm giving this encryption, so here you should have a linear system of equations, should be done. Until this stage is read, well, we do exactly random to math, hopefully in a reasonable way. We will have an agreeing stage, which will keep on going until everything is agreed pairwise. How in a moment. If we encounter, which shouldn't happen at the beginning, but can happen later during the algorithms, we have a symbol where all right-hand sides are dead, are gone. This means we made a wrong guess, and then we kind of have to roll back, and kind of shouldn't happen at the beginning. After this, we go to a gluing stage. These issues kind of, can we afford to glue anything? It can happen that we have only big symbols. Everything is kind of beyond 2 to the 10 or something. And the glue would be that large. Then we can't afford to glue because we run out of memory. Then we have to go to guessing. And so we'll guess a variable and hope. If not, glue. Reduce the number of symbols. The gluing of symbols is... well, it's arranged in such a way that the actual gluing takes place within individual MPUs. How to move things around for the moment, not discussed. And once all the gluing is done, you redistribute and keep on going again. Important now is that the gluing can do something like halving the number of symbols, so there's no need now to use all these MPUs. Actually, most of them have nothing to do now, so it will actually reduce the active area to work just here, and the other MPUs will in parallel process a different guess. So what you will do when you guess, you will put a guess 0 here, guess 1 there, and test in parallel. If one of them says, I'm unhappy, you know that that one was wrong. Okay. Now the question on how to actually do it. So how to organize the actual agreeing. We take one snake, so say all the symbols is the number G, and we don't care for the moment about agreeing kind of the symbols with the same number. That's kind of next slide. But we care about agreeing these symbols with all the rest. So kind of agreeing one snake with the other snakes. So what we will do is each MPU takes the symbol and pairwise agrees it with all the rest it has. That's just two symbols, it's just one symbol. During this time, well, some deletions might occur in the symbol of in the snake. Then you delete accordingly. And then the snake moves on, kind of along the Hamiltonian cycle. You just, all of the symbols with the number G move kind of to the next place in the Hamiltonian cycle. And that MPU does the same thing, so it agrees with everything it has there. Possibly some more deletions occur, then this occurs, that's nice. And you go on. Until eventually your snake kind of has gone one through the complete active area. Now what can have happened and should happen at some point is that possibly you had no deletions at all. In other words, you were already in agreement with everybody. That's fine. If this wasn't the case, this means well you will have to work again. That's kind of the worst case, but will also happen. But once you're through with the first stage, kind of your first snake is through, you leave it in peace and you go to the next snake, kind of the G minus one, and send it around. And you will notice you'll have some deletions or not. If you have deletions, you say, well, time to go again. You say, well, you get a higher number, another round, and another round, until you're through, yeah. At one point, we will be somewhere where all snakes are grouped with all the other snakes, but we never looked at the symbols within one snake, so this is something which we have to do now. And there are not too many surprises how this will be done. This is not a ridiculously large number, so what we can do, we can split our area and handle these snakes in parallel. You kind of load your symbols here, the other snake, the symbols there, and do the same as before, just on the small areas. The bad thing which can happen, when ideally now no deletions occur, nothing happens, everything was good. If now a deletion occurs, this means what we did before. Sorry guys, we have to go back. So then you have to possibly go back to the first stage again and agree again. So actually most of the time is spent here in disagreeing. Yes, really many agrees can take place before at some point you eventually reduce the number of symbols. So it kind of will be crucial to get this thing here reasonably fast. And of course, this kind of recursively goes down until you have just kind of two symbols and agree. But you might have to roll back a couple of times until really everything agrees. Once everything is in agreement, when we do the agreeing in a decent way, we will know, kind of the master processing unit will know which clues are possible. In other words, when we do the agreeing properly into some bookkeeping, we will know which symbols can be clued without crossing the threshold. So otherwise, this helps a lot, because otherwise you might start doing surprise, it's too large. But when you do some bookkeeping, which partner is found, how often, where, we will know exactly where we can do the clue. So then we do these clues, and well, we go back to agreeing, and if not, you will have to do guessing and storing in between. So I want to give a rough idea of this part here, but set for the low-level details, I skip that here. The main features, kind of the core components of accruing and agreeing, there's lots of overlap. So you have this matrix product, you have the same columns, same projections. There is one step in the gluing, which is original to that one, is where you have to form combinations of columns and add them up. This causes a little bit of nightmare, but this is doable. But the much of the remainder, you can essentially reuse resources. And one should really worry more about the agreeing than about the gluing. Okay, to give an idea how this looks like, I said for the moment you have to take my word for it, so I hope that by the end of the week you have an e-print where you can kind of check whether you believe these estimates. But it's a bit lengthy. What is worth noting, so one MPU, that's something like collection of seven chips, four of them have nothing else to do than making sure of sending and receiving symbols to the right place, essentially. A main issue is really memory and moving this data around. So it's not so much the computation, if you want, but it's kind of really four chips just for making sure things work appropriately, and was a little bit of struggle of keeping bandwidth as they should. Then we have essentially one chip, which is just the Clever Robot user, which produces this matrix Q, and that's kind of a nice parallel version of GF2 linear algebra. Then we have somewhere, because we have all these products, U with matrix this, U with matrix that, a multiplier, which neatly parallelizes that, more or less neatly. Yes, that's nothing too fancy, not too many surprises there. And then, as you see, we have no sorter or searcher. We decided to work with a hash table, which is a little bit of a dirty piece, but we started with sorting, searching, but ended up doing it with a kind of hash table, which will be used to check whether you have a partner and how many partners and which partner. That's happening here. And this last part is the guy which is only used for gluing and make sure of the adding up the right parts. Essentially, the guy consists of memory for storing this upper part of the matrices after the row reduction. It doesn't add too much to the overall size, but you'll need it, and it's kind of an issue. So if you add things up, and you believe me for the moment, one MPU is about 20 square centimeter of silicon. The individual chips are decent there, so it's not a big deal. Okay, and I would say that the two components which are perhaps of interest outside this stuff here is the multiplier. It's nothing too spectacular. If you think about how to do it fast, you probably come up with something similar. There are some details in making sure the gate depth doesn't get too excessive, because you won't have a clocking rate of more than 10 megahertz at the end. So there is a little bit of something. And otherwise, for the row reduce, it was kind of nice. There is literature available. So there is a design, some people might know, it's kind of a Smith, which does GF2 linear algebra already, nice parallel. The situation we had here is a little bit different than the typical case. So we did some changes here. Due to the systems we look at, our matrices are often very sparse. And this design might behave very bad when it runs in these cases, because that's just what they had in mind. So there was some tweaking there, and also we wanted to reduce the gate depth a little bit to get the clocking rate high. But if you look at this Jones design we have here, that's essentially Smith tweaked. So why invent the wheel new when it was there already? Okay. I won't get any lower in terms of detail level of the hardware than give the rough control flow of the algorithm, what's happening, how we do the agreeing of two symbols. So we have two symbols. They are stored in one of the units. Actually, that's part of the job of this traffic controller. You send the first matrix to this row reducer, you send the second matrix there. Why don't you send both at the same time? Because you don't have the bandwidth. So very simple. The row reducer, creates this matrix U. That's essentially Jones what's going on here. And this matrix P will be needed for the gluing step, but it's kind of computed anyway. It's not a big deal. If you have this condition we had at the beginning, that there is nothing down there in terms of zeros, well, then everything agrees and life is boring. Otherwise, we have to work. Now we have to multiply this matrix U with this zero symbol and symbol zero. So what's happening? We send the relevant columns of the matrix U to the multiplier. The multiplier now starts processing the right-hand side of the first symbol, kind of column by column. So the idea what you can have in mind, that kind of in each clock cycle it spits out one column. You don't really spit out a complete column, you kind of spit out a hash value because it's kind of smaller, but that's detail. This R part, that's the thing we have to compare at the end, is it here, is it there? Go to the hash table. And now here's a little bit a funny sentence. I could just say the hash table stores this R part and looks later when it's there. We need a little bit more, because here we set up this clue counter. You want to know something like how often is it produced, because you want to be able to use this data later to give an estimate how large the clue of these two symbols would be. So you store a little bit of extra data, which is not too expensive to do, but helps you a lot in cluing later. Also, the issue one has to keep in mind, we will have to kind of check whether the left symbol agrees with the right, and whether the right one agrees with the left. So what the hash table will actually do, it will not store only the values it gets from an hash table, but it will also just dump somewhere the complete inputs to use them later to just look them up when you work with the other matrix, because you have to agree on both sides. And kind of you run into trouble if you don't do this. But you don't trouble, you pay this one time simply. Once you're through kind of with the first symbol, well, you go to the other symbol, and the naive thing is same steps as before. You look it up in the hash table, and now better each R part you have is found in the hash table. If not, this means you have no partner, so you can say kick this column out. That's essentially what's happening here. Now what we need is now the agreeing the other way around. So when you look these guys here up, you throw them also in a hash table, kind of there are two copies actually, and take the earlier values and look them up there to see if they have partners also. If not, you kick those out. So there's a little bit of messy thing going on, but to save some running time there. That's this last step. step, which kind of does the crosswise comparison. In case there was no deletion nowhere, this means these two symbols are in agreement. You consider them later for gluing. The extra data we stored allows us now to give an estimate how large the glue will be. Because the new kind of this R value was produced 5 times, this was produced 10,000 times. So you get an idea how large the glue will be, and that will be reported. This helps later. Gluing looks very similar. The main issue there is that we have to send out around the big parts of the matrix which have to be added up. That's where the other comes into play, and I don't really want to detail that part. But roughly it's the same, it's just there's some extra fun with sending around these bigger parts. But it's not too much conceptually which is going on. Okay, now how does this thing behave? Said for the moment, you have to believe or not believe it, but should be able to read soon. First question is how do you meaningfully compare? What we decided here, so the K, how large is an MPU? Look about how much silicon you need per MPU. What is the cost roughly? Of course, this is a lie if you add initial development cost and so on. But kind of just if you assume this is done and the design is not too fancy. If you say the cost of one MPU is more or less the cost of one PC in terms of amount of silicon. So we compared the processing power kind of one MPU with one classical PC. That seems money-wise kind of fair. The dollar theory, US dollars, kind of doesn't really make a big difference. The problem is for, of course, all the digits PetSnake, we haven't implemented a small prototype or something so far. One can consider it, but we just haven't done it. What we have is, I think, decently optimized software implementation, where we have actual running times and have experiments. But the hardware times are estimated, yeah. So what we believe to be justified, because we kind of kept the gate under control and we think it's kind of okay, that we can run it with 1 GHz, but don't stick too much to this number if you think you can't do this and clock it down by a factor 4. That's nothing which worries me too much for the main message here. With the parameters we have and we believe the analysis to be decent, this thing seems to be, for an agreement in particular, about 4,000 times faster than the software. If you say this is all too aggressive here and you go, maybe we are completely off by a factor 20, say, it's still relevant, yeah? So it seems that this parallelization in hardware can really gain significantly. I want to say a little bit something why I believe kind of what is the reason behind it. I mean, like, this looks kind of ridiculous because I didn't give any low-level details. So I hope by the end of the week you should be able to read them, I hope. The main issue kind of what makes the hardware solution attractive here, this whole thing essentially consists of memory. We have lots of symbols and lots of symbols which have to move fast. If you look at one MPU alone, it has a little bit more than 4 GB. And we have on the whole device about 1,000 MPUs. So there's lots of memory lying around. And the MPUs, there's lots of fast communication going on. It's kind of all the time. They are communicating, sending around symbols. That's why we have 4 chips for traffic control. If you want to do this communication over a classical PC network, that seems rather challenging. Yeah, it's just, I don't want to say that it's impossible, but I think you need a rather elaborate network architecture to get somewhere in that range, yeah. So for going through the full process of a relevant cipher, it's really terabytes of data which have to be moved. And I think here is really where you're in trouble with the PC. I think you will end up swapping things out and hard disk, getting them back. And I think here is exactly where you lose compared to the hardware solution, yeah. So that's, I think it's kind of the idea where I think the hardware comes into play. Of course, it's fair to say if you look at this full device, that's ridiculously large if you want. That's kind of nothing you put in the kitchen table. And this is, of course, this thing is larger and it's large because you need some space for cooling and so on. The individual chips are not the problem. Individual chips are 4 cm or less. The issue is you have lots of them. Also, there's nothing wrong except your running time. In using here something smaller, yeah, it's fine. If you want to use 2^4 × 2^4, that's fine. You pay in the sense, it's kind of obvious how you pay, but it would make sense for testing. You have more symbols per MPU, and you spend more time just in processing them. So this is kind of, if you want, the aggressive choice. If you say, okay, what do you want to do? But still, even with this aggressive choice, it's impossible, or it would not be unfair, to make any claim you can do AES within blah, because but the essential statement you would need, MRHS needs that many steps, and then I can say, well, this, we have a speed up of. But as I don't know how many deletions occur at which stage, it's kind of bad to predict, yeah, so it's just how it is, yeah. It seems clear, we are significantly faster than software, but it's kind of the catchy statement against the particle block cipher we just can't make. Okay, so kind of the conclusion I want to make is, I think this algorithm is very attractive for doing it in hardware. And probably what we did is not the best way. There's much leeway you have. Maybe you want to, instead of our hash table, you want to do a clever sorting, searching a different way. Same thing in software. There are lots of little things you can play with. There are lots of switches and screws. What I liked is that some of the tasks involved are actually of interest outside this particular application. I mean, fasting algebra is always cool to have. And our particular hash table is very much geared for this one, but of course this task has some other applications. And so I hope some people will read this and follow up along this line, because I think this algorithm, it deserves some attention in terms of potential for this kind of systems for block ciphers. For the general purpose, possibly not the greatest tool, but I think for certain types of interest, it's an interesting technique. That's it. Thanks. It's a fair question. The full device, I think, is completely out of perspective. Once there's a certain maturity, I guess, one more paper by somebody else or something, I think looking at prototypes is attractive, kind of looking at small ones. And the whole thing is kind of, there's no point in having, you don't need a big device to understand that you can build a little multiplier, you can build a little hash table, so that would be meaningful to do. I have no time schedule for doing it. In particular, I think it would be wrong to do it now, because I'm sure there are a couple of tweaks which should be applied to this first architecture. Yeah. So that's,
yeah. What about prototyping it on FPGA?
Would be the way to go, of course, not an ASIC right away. I agree. Would be the next thing to do. We haven't done it, but that's the thing I would consider, yes. Exactly FPGAs, yeah. Say you pay in running time, but you can do it. That's the main issue. I completely agree. In particular, what also makes sense for this, Smith, for instance, has been implemented on FPGA. It's just there. So that would be a similar platform to build on. I completely agree. Mm-hmm?
You can speed up your attack by a factor of 4,000, likely. What does that mean for the actual cipher under attack?
It's a fair question. How long do you think does it take to solve for a key for an AES with a given plain text ciphertext pair with MRHS? We are faster. No, the issue is, I see the question is fair, but the question is, can we predict the running time of an algebraic attack against such a cipher? It's very tough. I mean, of course, we can play in software with two rounds of this, three rounds of that, maybe four rounds of that. Well, we don't have four rounds. So, and then it's kind of, from there, it's looking in the coffee and hoping. So it would be unfair in the statement there. I just don't know.
Have you actually done some sort of simulations in software? Do you have any experiments there?
Yeah, I mean, we have, I think, a decently optimized implementation in software of the algorithm, kind of how does clue actually look like, how do the matrices look like, how are they distributed. But it was an issue kind of, are these columns, do they look random or not? Well, if they have a completely strange distribution, the hash table would be unhappy. So then, okay, then we have to do there something.
Did you try something like a reduced round ES or something? I mean,
Yeah, sure. You take actual ciphers and present. We play just a few rounds to actually see how the things develop, to get an idea of the distribution of the data. It's crucial because, I mean, there were some surprises. I mean, yeah, this should be approximately uniform to distribute and whoosh, 10,000 hit on the same spot. Said, well, if I do the hash table like this, it will not survive. I think on that side, I think we're kind of reasonably stable. But of course, you can always argue, which is fair, say, your software was not that clever, I'm more clever, I can speed you up by a factor two. Maybe yes, but I think that the underlying statement is kind of, it seems you can really gain magnitudes, yeah, and whether it's now 4,000 or 1,000, I don't really care, but it seems there is significant potential, that is what I see, yeah. I mean, it would be more interesting to have a statement like, oh, AES in 1 year, yes, no. But it would not be appropriate to say it, because we just have, the algorithms are not understood well enough. I like them.
Any final questions, comments? And let's ask Ryder once again.